Because he was accepted at the system manager level, the highest security clearance, all functions were available to him. He could use the task force's computer as long as he wanted for whatever purpose he wished, and his presence wouldn't be observed or recorded. He had no interest in their files. He used their computer only as a jumping-off point into the Los Angeles Police Department system, to which they had direct access. The irony of employing a computer crime unit's hardware and software to commit even a minor computer crime was appealing. It was also dangerous. Nearly everything that was fun, of course, was also a little dangerous. Riding roller coasters, skydiving, gambling, sex. From the LAPD system, he entered the California Department of Motor Vehicles computer in Sacramento. He got such a kick from making those leaps that he felt almost as though he had traveled physically, teleporting from his canyon in Malibu to Los Angeles to Sacramento in the manner of a character in a science fiction novel. Rocky jumped onto his hind legs, planted his forepaws on the edge of the desk, and peered at the computer screen. "You wouldn't enjoy this," Spencer said. Rocky looked at him and issued a short, soft whine. "I'm sure you get a lot more pleasure from chewing on that new rawhide bone I got you." Peering at the screen again, Rocky inquisitively cocked his furry head. "Or I could put on some Paul Simon for you." Another whine, longer and louder than before. Sighing, Spencer pulled another chair next to his own. "All right. When a fella has a bad case of the lonelies, I guess chewing on a rawhide bone just isn't as good as having a little company. Never works for me, anyway." Rocky hopped into the chair, panting and grinning. Together they went voyaging in cyberspace, plunging illegally into the galaxy of DMV records, searching for Valerie Keene. They found her in seconds. Spencer had hoped for an address different from the one he already knew, but he was disappointed. She was listed at the bungalow in Santa Monica, where he had discovered unfurnished rooms and the photo of a cockroach nailed to one wall. According to the data that scrolled up the screen, she had a Class C license without restrictions. It would expire in little less than 4 years. She had applied for the license and taken a written test in early December, 2 months ago. Her middle name was Anne. She was 29. Spencer had guessed 25. Her driving record was free of violations. In the event that she was gravely injured and her own life could not be saved, she had authorized the donation of her vital organs. Otherwise, the DMV offered little information about her. Sex, female. Hair, brown. Eyes, brown. Height, 5'4". Weight, 115. That bureaucratic thumbnail description wouldn't be of much help when Spencer needed to describe her to someone. It was insufficient to conjure an image that included the things that truly distinguished her. The direct and clear-eyed stare, the slightly lopsided smile, the dimple in her right cheek, the delicate line of her jaw. Since last year, with federal funding from the National Crime and Terrorism Prevention Act, the California DMV had been digitizing and electronically storing photographs and thumbprints of new and renewing drivers. Eventually, there would be mugshots and prints on file for every resident with a driver's license, though the vast majority had never been accused of a crime, let alone convicted. Spencer considered this the first step toward a national ID card, an internal passport of the type that had been required in the communist states before they had collapsed, and he was opposed to it on principle. In this instance, however, his principles didn't prevent him from calling up the photo from Valerie's license. The screen flickered, and she appeared, smiling. The banshee eucalyptuses whisper-wailed complaints of eternity's indifference, and the rain drummed, drummed. Spencer realized that he was holding his breath. He exhaled. Peripherally, he was aware of Rocky staring at him curiously, then at the screen, then at him again. He picked up the mug and sipped some black coffee. His hand was shaking. Valerie had known that authorities of one kind or another were hunting her, and she had known that they were getting close because she had vacated her bungalow only hours before they'd come for her. If she was innocent, why would she settle for the unstable and fear-filled life of a fugitive? Putting the mug aside and his fingers to the keyboard, he asked for a hard copy of the photo on the screen. The laser printer hummed. A single sheet of white paper slid out of the machine. Valerie, smiling. In Santa Monica, no one had called for surrender before the assault on the bungalow had begun. When the attackers burst inside, there had been no warning shouts of police. Yet Spencer was certain that those men had been officers of one law enforcement agency or another because of their uniform-like dress, night vision goggles, weaponry, and military methodology. Valerie, smiling. That soft-voiced woman with whom Spencer had talked last night at the Red Door had seemed gentle and honest, less capable of deceit than were most people. First thing, she had looked boldly at his scar and had asked about it, not with pity welling in her eyes, not with an edge of morbid curiosity in her voice, but in the same way that she might have asked where he'd bought the shirt he'd been wearing. Most people studied the scar surreptitiously and managed to speak of it, if at all, only when they realized that he was aware of their intense curiosity. Valerie's frankness had been refreshing. When he told her only that he'd been in an accident when he was a child, Valerie had sensed that he either didn't want or wasn't able to talk about it, and she had dropped the subject as if it mattered no more than his hairstyle. Thereafter, he never caught her gaze straying to the pallid brand on his face. More important, he never had the feeling that she was struggling not to look. She found other things about him more interesting than that pale welt from ear to chin. Valerie, in black and white. He could not believe that this woman was capable of committing a major crime, and certainly not one so heinous that a SWAT team would come after her in utmost silence with submachine guns and every high-tech advantage. She might be traveling with someone dangerous. Spencer doubted that. He reviewed the few clues. One set of dinnerware, one drinking glass, one set of stainless steel flatware, an air mattress adequate for one but too small for two. Yet the possibility remained. She might not be alone, and the person with her might rate the extreme caution of the SWAT team. The photo, printed from the computer screen, was too dark to do her justice. Spencer directed the laser printer to produce another, just a shade lighter than the first. That printout was better, and he asked for 5 more copies. Until he held her likeness in his hands, Spencer had not been consciously aware that he was going to follow Valerie Keene wherever she had gone, find her, and help her. Regardless of what she might have done, even if she was guilty of a crime, regardless of the cost to himself, whether or not she could ever care for him, Spencer was going to stand with this woman against whatever darkness she faced. As he realized the deeper implications of the commitment that he was making, a chill of wonder shivered him. For until that moment, he had thought of himself as a thoroughly modern man who believed in no one and nothing, neither in God Almighty nor in himself. Softly, touched by awe and unable fully to understand his own motivations, he said, "I'll be damned." The dog sneezed. Chapter 4. By the time the Beatles were singing "I'll Cry Instead," Roy Miro detected a cooling in the dead woman's hand that had begun to seep into his own flesh. He let go of her and put on his gloves. He wiped her hands with one corner of the top sheet to smear any oils from his own skin that might have left the patterns of his fingertips. Filled with conflicting emotions, grief at the death of a good woman, joy at her release from a world of pain and disappointment, he went downstairs to the kitchen. He wanted to be in a position to hear the automatic garage door when Penelope's husband came home. A few spots of blood had congealed on the tile floor. Roy used paper towels and a spray bottle of Fantastic, which he found in the cabinet under the kitchen sink, to clean away the mess. After he wiped up the dirty prints of his galoshes as well, he noticed that the stainless steel sink wasn't as well kept as it could have been, and he scrubbed it until it was spotless. The window in the microwave was smeared. It sparkled when he was done with it. By the time the Beatles were halfway through "I'll Be Back," and Roy had wiped down the front of the Sub-Zero refrigerator, the garage door rumbled upward. He threw the used paper towels into the trash compactor, put away the Fantastic, and retrieved the Beretta that he had left on the counter after delivering Penelope from her suffering. The kitchen and garage were separated only by a small laundry room. He turned to that closed door. The rumble of the car engine echoed off the garage walls as Sam Bettenfield drove inside. The engine cut off. The big door clattered and creaked as it rolled down behind the car. Home from the accountant wars at last, weary of working late, crunching numbers, weary of paying high office rents in Century City, trying to stay afloat in a system that valued money more than people. In the garage, a car door slammed. Burned out from the stress of life in a city that was riddled with injustice and at war with itself, Sam would be looking forward to a drink, a kiss from Penelope, a late dinner, perhaps an hour of television. Those simple pleasures and 8 hours of restful sleep constituted the poor man's only respite from his greedy and demanding clients, and his sleep was likely to be tormented by bad dreams. Roy had something better to offer. Blessed escape. The sound of a key in the lock between the garage and the house, the clack of the deadbolt, a door opening. Sam entered the laundry. Roy raised the Beretta as the inner door opened. Wearing a raincoat, carrying a briefcase, Sam stepped into the kitchen. He was a balding man with quick, dark eyes. He looked startled, but sounded at ease. "You must have the wrong house." Eyes misting with tears, Roy said, "I know what you're going through," and he squeezed off 3 quick shots. Sam was not a large man, perhaps 50 pounds heavier than his wife. Nevertheless, getting him upstairs to the bedroom, wrestling him out of his raincoat, pulling off his shoes, and hoisting him into bed was not easy. When the task had been accomplished, Roy felt good about himself because he knew that he had done the right thing by placing Sam and Penelope together and in dignified circumstances. He pulled the bedclothes over Sam's chest. The top sheet was trimmed with cutwork lace to match the pillow sham, so the dead couple appeared to be dressed in fancy surplices of the sort that angels might wear. The Beatles had stopped singing a while ago. Outside, the soft and somber sound of the rain was as cold as the city that received it, as relentless as the passage of time and the fading of all light. Though he had done a caring thing, and though there was joy in the end of these people's suffering, Roy was sad. It was a strangely sweet sadness, and the tears that had wrung from him were cleansing. Eventually, he went downstairs to clean up the few drops of Sam's blood that spotted the kitchen floor. He found the vacuum cleaner in the big closet under the stairs, and he swept away the dirt that he had tracked on the carpet when he'd first come into the house. In Penelope's purse, he searched for the business card that he had given her. The name on it was phony, but he retrieved it anyway. Finally, using the telephone in the study, he dialed 911. When a policewoman answered, Roy said, "It's very sad here. It's very sad. Someone should come right away." He did not return the handset to the cradle, but put it down on the desk, leaving the line open. The Bettenfields' address should have appeared on a computer screen in front of the policewoman who had answered the call, but Roy didn't want to take the chance that Sam and Penelope might be there for hours or even days before they were found. They were good people and did not deserve the indignity of being discovered stiff, gray, and reeking of decomposition. He carried his galoshes and shoes to the front door, where he quickly put them on again. He remembered to pick up the lock release gun from the foyer floor. He walked through the rain to his car and drove away from there. According to his watch, the time was 10:20. Although it was 3 hours later on the East Coast, Roy was sure that his contact in Virginia would be waiting. At the first red traffic light, he popped open the attaché case on the passenger seat. He plugged in the computer, which was still married to the cellular phone. He didn't separate the devices because he needed both. With a few quick keystrokes, he set up the cellular unit to respond to pre-programmed vocal instructions and to function as a speakerphone, which freed both his hands for driving. As the traffic light turned green, he crossed the intersection and made the long-distance call by saying, "Please connect," and then reciting the number in Virginia. After the second ring, the familiar voice of Thomas Summerton came down the line, recognizable by a single word as smooth and as southern as pecan butter. "Hello?" Roy said, "May I speak to Jerry, please?"
"Sorry, wrong number." Summerton hung up.
Roy terminated the resultant dial tone by saying, "Please disconnect now." In 10 minutes, Summerton would call back from a secure phone, and they could speak freely without fear of being recorded. Roy drove past the glitzy shops on Rodeo Drive to Santa Monica Boulevard and then west into residential streets. Large, expensive houses stood among huge trees, palaces of privilege that he found offensive.
When the phone rang, he didn't reach for the keypad, but said, "Please accept call." The connection was made with an audible click. "Please scramble now," Roy said. The computer beeped to indicate that everything he said would be rendered unintelligible to anyone between him and Summerton. As it was transmitted, their speech would be broken into small pieces of sound and rearranged by a random-like control factor. Both phones were synchronized with the same control factor, so the meaningless streams of transmitted sound would be reassembled into intelligible speech when received.
"I've seen the early report on Santa Monica," Summerton said.
"According to neighbors, she was there this morning, but she must have skipped by the time we set up surveillance this afternoon."
"What tipped her off?"
"I swear she has a sixth sense about us." Roy turned west on Sunset Boulevard, joining the heavy flow of traffic that gilded the wet pavement with headlight beams. "You heard about the man who showed up?"
"And got away."
"We weren't sloppy."
"So he was just lucky?"
"No worse than that. He knew what he was doing."
"You're saying he's somebody with a history?"
"Yeah."
"Local, state, or federal history?"
"He took out a team member, neat as you please."
"So he's had a few lessons beyond the local level."
Roy turned right off Sunset Boulevard onto a less traveled street where mansions were hidden behind walls, high hedges, and wind-tossed trees. "If we're able to chase him down, what's our priority with him?" Summerton considered for a moment before he spoke.
"Find out who he is, who he's working for."
"Then detain him?"
"No. Too much is at stake. Make him disappear."
The serpentine streets wound through the wooded hills among secluded estates overhung by dripping branches through blind turn after blind turn. Roy said, "Does this change our priority with the woman?"
"No. Whack her on sight. Anything else happening at your end?"
Roy thought of Mr. and Mrs. Bettenfield, but he didn't mention them. The extreme kindness he had extended to them had nothing to do with his job, and Summerton would not understand. Instead, Roy said, "She left something for us." Summerton said nothing, perhaps because he intuited what the woman had left. Roy said, "A photo of a cockroach nailed to the wall."
"Whack her hard," Summerton said, and he hung up.
As Roy followed a long curve under drooping magnolia boughs, past a wrought iron fence beyond which a replica of Tara stood spotlighted in the rain-swept darkness, he said, "Cease scrambling." The computer beeped to indicate compliance. "Please connect," he said, and recited the telephone number that would bring him into Mama's arms. The video display flickered. When Roy glanced at the screen, he saw the opening question.
"Who goes there?"
Though the phone would react to vocal commands, Mama would not. Therefore, Roy pulled off the narrow road and stopped in a driveway before a pair of 9-foot-high wrought iron gates to type in his responses to the security interrogation. After the transmission of his thumbprint, he was granted access to Mama in Virginia. From her basic menu, he chose field offices. From that sub-menu, he chose Los Angeles, and he was thereby connected to the largest of Mama's babies on the West Coast. He went through a few menus in the Los Angeles computer until he arrived at the files of the photo analysis department. The file that interested him was currently in play, as he knew it would be, and he tapped in to observe. The screen of his portable computer went to black and white, and then it filled with a photograph of a man's head from the neck up. His face was turned half away from the camera, dappled with shadows, blurred by a curtain of rain. Roy was disappointed. He had hoped for a clearer picture. This was dismayingly like an impressionist painting, in general, recognizable, in specific, mysterious. Earlier in the evening in Santa Monica, the surveillance team had taken photographs of the stranger who had gone into the bungalow minutes prior to the SWAT team assault. The night, the heavy rain, and the overgrown trees that prevented the street lamps from casting much light on the sidewalk all conspired to make it difficult to get a clear look at the man. Furthermore, they had not been expecting him, had thought that he was only an ordinary pedestrian who would pass by, and had been unpleasantly surprised when he'd turned in at the woman's house. Consequently, they had gotten precious few shots, none of quality, and none that revealed the full face of the mystery man. though the camera had been equipped with a telephoto lens. The best of the photographs already had been scanned into the local office computer, where it was being processed by an enhancement program. The computer would attempt to identify rain distortion and eliminate it. Then it would gradually lighten all areas of the shot uniformly until it was able to identify biological structures in the deepest shadows that fell across the face. Employing its extensive knowledge of human skull formation, with an enormous catalog of the variations that occurred between the sexes, among the races, and among age groups, the computer would interpret the structures it glimpsed and develop them on a best guess basis. The process was laborious even at the lightning speed with which the program operated. Any photograph could ultimately be broken down into tiny dots of light and shadow called pixels, puzzle pieces that were identically shaped but varied subtly in texture and shading. Every one of the hundreds of thousands of pixels in this photograph had to be analyzed to decipher not merely what it represented, but what its undistorted relationship was to each of the many pixels surrounding it, which meant that the computer had to make hundreds of millions of comparisons and decisions in order to clarify the image. Even then, there was no guarantee that the face finally rising from the murk would be an entirely accurate depiction of the man who had been photographed. Any analysis of this kind was as much an art or guesswork as it was a reliable technological process. Roy had seen instances in which a computer-enhanced portrait was as off the mark as any amateur artist's paint-by-the-numbers canvas of the Arc de Triomphe or of Manhattan at twilight. However, the face that they eventually got from the computer most likely would be so close to the man's true appearance as to be an exact likeness. Now, as the computer made decisions and adjusted thousands of pixels, the image on the video display rippled from left to right. Still disappointing. Although changes had occurred, their effect was imperceptible. Roy was unable to see how the man's face was any different from what it had been before the adjustment. For the next several hours, the image on the screen would ripple every 6 to 10 seconds. The cumulative effect could be appreciated only by checking it at widely spaced intervals. Roy backed out of the driveway, leaving the computer plugged in and the VDT angled toward him. For a while, he chased his headlights up and down hills, around blind turns, searching for a way out of the folded darkness where the tree-filtered lights of cloistered mansions hinted at mysterious lives of wealth and power beyond his understanding. From time to time, he glanced at the computer screen, the rippling face, half-averted, shadowy and strange. When at last he found Sunset Boulevard again, and then the lower streets of Westwood, not far from his hotel, he was relieved to be back among people who were more like himself than those who lived in the moneyed hills. In the lower lands, the citizens knew suffering and uncertainty. There were people whose lives he could affect for the better, people to whom he could bring a measure of justice and mercy, one way or another. The face on the computer screen was still that of a phantom, amorphous and possibly malignant. The face of chaos. The stranger was a man who, like the fugitive woman, stood in the way of order, stability, and justice. He might be evil or merely troubled and confused. In the end, it didn't matter which. "I'll give you peace," Roy Miro promised, glancing at the slowly mutating face on the video display terminal. "I'll find you and give you peace." Chapter 5. While hooves of rain beat across the roof, while the troll deep voice of the wind grumbled at the windows, and while the dog lay curled and dozing on the adjacent chair, Spencer used his computer expertise to try to build a file on Valerie Keene. According to the records of the Department of Motor Vehicles, the driver's license for which she'd applied had been her first, not a renewal. And to get it, she had supplied a Social Security card as proof of identity. The DMV had verified that her name and number were indeed paired in the Social Security Administration's files. That gave Spencer 4 indices with which to locate her in other databases where she was likely to appear: name, date of birth, driver's license number, and Social Security number. Learning more about her should be a snap. Last year, with much patience and cunning, he'd made a game of getting into all the major nationwide credit reporting agencies, like TRW, which were among the most secure of all systems. Now he wormed into the largest of those apples again, seeking Valerie Ann Keene. Their files included 42 women by that name, 59 when the surname was spelled either K-E-E-N-E or K-E-A-N-E, and 64 when a third spelling, K-E-E-N, was added. Spencer entered her social security number, expecting to winnow away 63 of the 64, but none had the same number as that in the DMV records. Frowning at the screen, he entered Valerie's birthday and asked the system to locate her with that. One of the 64 Valeries was born on the same day of the same month as the woman whom he was hunting, but 20 years earlier. With the dog snoring beside him, he entered the driver's license number and waited while the system cross-checked the Valeries. Of those who were licensed drivers, 5 were in California, but none had a number that matched hers. Another dead end. Convinced that mistakes must have been made in the data entries, Spencer examined the file for each of the 5 California Valeries, looking for a driver's license or date of birth that was one number different from the information he had gotten out of the DMV. He was sure he would discover that a data entry clerk had typed a 6 when a 9 was required or had transposed 2 numbers. Nothing. No mistakes. And judging by the information in each file, none of those women could possibly be the right Valerie. Incredibly, the Valerie Ann Keene, who had recently worked at the Red Door, was absent from credit agency files, utterly without a credit history. That was possible only if she had never purchased anything on time payments, had never possessed a credit card of any kind, had never opened a checking or savings account, and had never been the subject of a background check by an employer or landlord. To be 29 years old without acquiring a credit history in modern America, she would have to have been a gypsy or a jobless vagrant most of her life, at least since she'd been a teenager. Manifestly, she had not been any such thing. Okay, think. The raid on her bungalow meant one kind of police agency or another was after her, so she must be a wanted felon with a criminal record. Spencer returned along electronic freeways to the Los Angeles Police Department computer, through which he searched city, county, and state court records to see if anyone by the name of Valerie Ann Keene had ever been convicted of a crime or had an outstanding arrest warrant in those jurisdictions. The city system flashed negative on the video screen. No file, reported the county. Not found, said the state. Nothing. Nada. Zero. Zip. Using the LAPD's electronic information sharing arrangement with the FBI, he accessed the Washington-based Justice Department files of people convicted of federal offenses. She wasn't included in those, either. In addition to its famous 10 most wanted list, the FBI was, at any given time, seeking hundreds of other people related to criminal investigations, either suspects or potential witnesses. Spencer inquired if her name appeared on any of those lists, but it did not. She was a woman without a past. Yet something that she'd done had made her a wanted woman, desperately wanted. Spencer did not get to bed until 1:10 in the morning. Although he was exhausted, and although the rhythm of the rain should have served as a sedative, he couldn't sleep. He lay on his back, staring alternately at the shadowy ceiling and at the thrashing foliage of the trees beyond the window, listening to the meaningless monologue of the blustery wind. At first he could think of nothing but the woman, the look of her, those eyes, that voice, that smile, the mystery. In time, however, his thoughts drifted to the past, as they did too often, too easily. For him, reminiscence was a highway with one destination. That certain summer night when he was 14, when a dark world became darker, when everything he knew was proved false, when hope died, and a dread of destiny became his constant companion, when he awakened to the cry of a persistent owl whose single inquiry thereafter became the central question of his own life. Rocky, who was usually so well attuned to his master's moods, was still restlessly pacing. He seemed to be unaware that Spencer was sinking into the quiet anguish of stubborn memory, and that he needed company. The dog didn't respond to his name when called. In the gloom, Rocky padded restlessly back and forth between the open bedroom door, where he stood on the threshold and listened to the storm that huffed in the fireplace chimney, and the bedroom window, where he put his forepaws upon the sill and stared out at the rampage of the wind through the eucalyptus grove. Although he neither whined nor grumbled, he had about him an air of anxiety, as if the bad weather had blown an unwanted memory out of his own past, leaving him bedeviled and unable to regain the peace he had known while dozing on the chair in the living room.
"Here, boy," Spencer said softly. "Come here."
Unheeding, the dog padded to the door, a shadow among shadows. Tuesday evening, Spencer had gone to the Red Door to talk about a night in July 16 years past. Instead, he met Valerie Keene, and to his surprise, talked of other things. That distant July, however, still haunted him.
"Rocky, come here."
Spencer patted the mattress. A minute or so of further encouragement finally brought the dog onto the bed. Rocky lay with his head on Spencer's chest, shivering at first, but quickly soothed by his master's hand. One ear up, one ear down, he was attentive to the story that he'd heard on countless nights like this, when he was the entire audience, and on nights when he accompanied Spencer into bar rooms where drinks were bought for strangers who would listen in an alcoholic haze.
"I was 14, Spencer began. "It was the middle of July, and the night was warm, humid. I was asleep under just one sheet with my bedroom window open so the air could circulate. I remember I was dreaming about my mother, who'd been dead more than 6 years by then. But I can't remember anything that happened in the dream, only the warmth of it, the contentment, the comfort of being with her, and maybe the music of her laughter. She had a wonderful laugh. But it was another sound that woke me. Not because it was loud, but because it was recurring. So hollow and strange. I sat up in bed, confused, half-drugged with sleep, but not frightened at all. I heard someone asking, 'Who?' again and again. There would be a pause, silence, but then it would repeat as before. 'Who? Who? Who?' Of course, as I came all the way awake, I realized it was an owl perched on the roof just above my open window." Spencer was again drawn to that distant July night, like an asteroid captured by the greater gravity of the Earth and doomed to a declining orbit that would end in impact. "It's an owl perched on the roof just above my open window, calling out in the night, for whatever reason owls call out. In the humid dark, I get up from my bed and go to the bathroom, expecting the hooting to stop when the hungry owl takes wing and goes hunting for mice again. But even after I return to bed, he seems to be content on the roof and pleased by his one-word, one-note song. Finally, I go to the open window and quietly slide up the double-hung screen, trying not to startle him into flight. But when I lean outside, turning my head to look up, half expecting to see his talons hooked over the shingles and curved in toward the eaves, another and far different cry arises before I can say, 'Shoo,' or the owl can ask, 'Who?' This new sound is thin and bleak, a fragile wail of terror from a far place in the summer night. I look out toward the barn, which stands 200 yards behind the house, toward the moonlit fields beyond the barn, toward the wooded hills beyond the fields. The cry comes again, shorter this time, but even more pathetic and therefore more piercing. Having lived in the country since the day I was born, I know that nature is one great killing ground governed by the cruelest of all laws, the law of natural selection, and ruled by the ruthless. Many nights I've heard the eerie, quavery yawling of coyote packs chasing prey and celebrating slaughter, the triumphant shriek of a mountain lion after it has torn the life out of a rabbit sometimes echoes out of the highlands, a sound which makes it easy to believe that hell is real and that the damned have flung open the gates. This cry that catches my attention as I lean out the window and that silences the owl on the roof comes not from a predator, but from prey.
It's the voice of something weak, vulnerable. The forests and fields are filled with timid and meek creatures which live only to perish violently, which do so every hour of every day without surcease, whose terror may actually be noticed by a god who knows of every sparrow's fall but seems unmoved. Suddenly the night is profoundly quiet, uncannily still, as if the distant bleat of fear was, in fact, the sound of creation's engines grinding to a halt. The stars are hard points of light that have stopped twinkling, and the moon might as well be painted on canvas. The landscape, trees, shrubs, summer flowers, fields, hills, and far mountains, appears to be nothing but crystallized shadows in various dark hues as brittle as ice. The air must still be warm, but I am nonetheless frigid. I quietly close the window, turn away from it, and move toward the bed again. I feel heavy-eyed, wearier than I've ever been. But then I realize that I'm in a strange state of denial, that my weariness is less physical than psychological, that I desire sleep more than I really need it. Sleep is an escape from fear. I'm shaking, but not because I'm cold. The air is as warm as it was earlier. I'm shaking with fear. Fear of what? I can't quite identify the source of my anxiety. I know that the thing I heard was no ordinary wild cry. It reverberates in my mind, an icy sound that recalls something I've heard once before. Although I can't remember what, when, where. The longer the forlorn wail echoes in my memory, the faster my heart beats. I desperately want to lie down. Forget the cry, the night, the owl, and his question. But I know I can't sleep. I'm wearing only briefs, so I quickly pull on a pair of jeans. Now that I'm committed to act, denial and sleep have no attraction for me. In fact, I'm in the grip of an urgency, at least as strange as the previous denial. Bare-chested and barefoot, I'm drawn out of my bedroom by intense curiosity, by the sense of post-midnight adventure that all boys share, and by a terrible truth, which I don't yet know that I know. Beyond my door, the house is cool, because my room is the only one not air-conditioned. For several summers, I've closed the vents against that chill flow, because I prefer the benefits of fresh air, even on a humid July night. And because, for some years, I've been unable to sleep with the hiss and hum that the icy air makes as it rushes through the ductwork and seethes through the veins in the vent grill. I've long been afraid that this incessant, if subtle, noise will mask some other sound in the night that I must hear in order to survive. I have no idea what that other sound would be. It's a groundless and childish fear, and I'm embarrassed by it. Yet it dictates my sleeping habits. The upstairs hallway is silvered with moonlight, which streams to a pair of skylights. Here and there along both walls, the polished pine floor glimmers softly. Down the middle of the hall is an intricately patterned Persian runner, in which the curved and curled and undulant shapes absorb the radiance of the full moon and glow dimly with it. Hundreds of pale, luminous, cylindric forms seem to be not immediately under my feet, but well below me, as if I am not on a carpet, but am walking Christ-like on the surface of a tide pool while gazing down at the mysterious denizens on the bottom. I pass my father's room. The door is closed. I reach the head of the stairs where I hesitate. The house is silent. I descend the stairs quaking, rubbing my bare arms with my hands, wondering at my inexplicable fear. Perhaps even at that moment, I dimly realize that I am going down to a place from which I'll never again quite be able to ascend. With the dog as his confessor, Spencer spun his story all the way through that long-ago night to the hidden door, to the secret place, to the beating heart of the nightmare. As he recounted the experience step by barefoot step, his voice faded to a whisper. When he finished, he was in a temporary state of grace that would burn away with the coming of the dawn, but it was even sweeter for being so tenuous and brief. Purged, he was at last able to close his eyes and know that dreamless sleep would come to him. In the morning, he would begin to search for the woman. He had the uneasy feeling that he was walking into a living hell to rival the one that he had so often described to the patient dog. He could do nothing else. Only one acceptable road lay ahead of him, and he was compelled to follow it. Now sleep. Rain washed the world, and its susurration was the sound of absolution, though some stains could never be permanently removed. Chapter 6. In the morning, Spencer had a few tiny bruises and red marks on his face and hands from the sting grenade pellets. Compared with his scar, they would draw no comments. For breakfast, he had English muffins and coffee at his desk in the living room, while he hacked into the county tax collector's computer. He discovered that the bungalow in Santa Monica, where Valerie had been living until the previous day, was owned by the Lewis and May Lee Family Trust. Property tax bills were mailed in care of something called China Dream in West Hollywood. Out of curiosity, he requested a list of other properties, if any, owned by that trust. There were 14. 5 more homes in Santa Monica, a pair of 8-unit apartment buildings in Westwood, 3 single-family homes in Bel Air, and 4 adjacent commercial buildings in West Hollywood, including the address for China Dream. Lewis and May Lee had done all right for themselves. After switching off the computer, Spencer stared at the blank screen and finished his coffee. It was bitter. He drank it anyway. By 10 o'clock, he and Rocky were heading south on the Pacific Coast Highway. Traffic passed him at every opportunity because he obeyed the speed limit. The storm had moved east during the night, taking every cloud with it. The morning sun was white, and in its hard light the westward tilting shadows had edges as sharp as steel blades. The Pacific was bottle green and slate gray. Spencer tuned the radio to an all-news station. He hoped to hear a story about the SWAT team raid the night before and to learn who had been in charge of it and why Valerie was wanted. The newsreader informed him that taxes were going up again. The economy was slipping deeper into recession. The government was further restricting gun ownership and television violence. Robbery, rape, and homicide rates were at all-time highs. The Chinese were accusing us of possessing orbiting laser death rays, and we were accusing them of the same. Some people believed that the world would end in fire. Others said ice. Both were testifying before Congress on behalf of competing legislative agendas designed to save the world. When he found himself listening to a story about a dog show that was being picketed by protesters who were demanding an end to selective breeding and to the exploitation of animal beauty in an exhibitionistic performance no less repugnant than the degrading of young women in topless bars, Spencer knew that there would be no report of the incident at the bungalow in Santa Monica. Surely a SWAT team operation would rate higher on any reporter's agenda than unseemly displays of canine comeliness. Either the media had found nothing newsworthy in an assault on a private home by cops with machine guns, or the agency conducting the operation had done a first-rate job of misdirecting the press. They had turned what should have been a public spectacle into what amounted to a covert action. He switched off the radio and entered the Santa Monica freeway. East by northeast, in the lower hills, the China Dream awaited them. To Rocky, he said, "What's your opinion of this dog show thing?" Rocky looked at him curiously. "You're a dog. After all, you must have an opinion. These are your people being exploited." Either he was a dog of extreme circumspection when it came to discussing current events, or he was just a carefree, culturally disengaged mutt with no positions on the weightiest social issues of his time and species. "I would hate to think," Spencer said, "that you are a dropout, resigned to the status of a lumpen mammal, unconcerned about being exploited, all fur and no fury." Rocky peered forward at the highway again. "Aren't you outraged that purebred females are forbidden to have sex with mongrels like you, forced to submit only to purebred males, just to make puppies destined for the degradation of show rings?" The mutt's tail thumped against the passenger door. "Good dog." Spencer held the steering wheel with his left hand and patted Rocky with his right. The dog submitted with pleasure. Thump, thump went the tail. "A good, accepting dog. You don't even think it's strange that your master talks to himself." They exited the freeway at Robertson Boulevard and drove toward the fabled hills. After the night of rain and wind, the sprawling metropolis was as free of smog as the seacoast from which they had traveled. The palms, ficuses, magnolias, and early-blooming bottlebrush trees with red flowers were so green and gleaming that they appeared to have been hand-polished, leaf by leaf, frond by frond. The streets were washed clean, the glass walls of the tall buildings sparkled in the sunshine, birds wheeled across the piercingly blue sky, and it was easy to be deceived into believing that all was right with the world. Thursday morning, while other agents used the assets of several law enforcement organizations to search for the 9-year-old Pontiac that was registered to Valerie Keene, Roy Miro personally took charge of the effort to identify the man who had nearly been captured in the previous night's operation. From his Westwood hotel, he drove into the heart of Los Angeles to the agency's California headquarters. Downtown, the volume of office space occupied by city, county, state, and federal governments was rivaled only by the space occupied by banks. At lunchtime, the conversation in the restaurants was more often than not about money, massive, raw slabs of money, whether the diners were from the political or the financial community. In its opulent wallow, the agency owned a handsome 10-story building on a desirable street near City Hall. Bankers, politicians, bureaucrats, and wine-swilling derelicts shared the sidewalks with mutual respect, except for those regrettable occasions when one of them suddenly snapped, screamed incoherent deprecations, and savagely stabbed one of his fellow Angelinos. The wielder of the knife or gun or blunt instrument frequently suffered delusions of persecution by extraterrestrials or the CIA, and was more likely to be a derelict than a banker or a politician or a bureaucrat. Just 6 months ago, however, a middle-aged banker had gone on a killing spree with 2 9-millimeter pistols. The incident had traumatized the entire society of downtown vagrants and had made them more wary of the unpredictable suits who shared the streets with them. The agency's building, clad in limestone with acres of bronze windows as dark as any movie star's sunglasses, did not bear the agency's name. The people for whom Roy worked weren't glory-seekers. They preferred to function in obscurity. Besides, the agency that employed them did not officially exist. It was funded by the clandestine redirection of money from other bureaus that were under the control of the Justice Department, and actually had no name itself. Over the main entrance, the street address gleamed in polished copper numbers. Under the numbers were 4 names and 1 ampersand, also in copper. Carver, Gunman, Garrett, and Hemlock. A passerby, if he wondered about the building's occupant, might think it was a partnership of attorneys or accountants. If he made inquiries of the uniformed guard in the lobby, he would be told that the firm was an international property management company. Roy drove down a ramp to the underground parking facility. At the bottom of the ramp, the way was barred by a sturdy steel gate. He gained admittance neither by plucking a time-stamped ticket from an automatic dispenser nor by identifying himself to a guard in a booth. Instead, he stared directly into the lens of a high-definition video camera that was mounted on a post 2 feet from the side window of his car and waited to be recognized. The image of his face was transmitted to a windowless room in the basement. There, Roy knew, a guard at a display terminal watched as the computer dropped everything out of the image except the eyes, enlarged them without compromising the high resolution, scanned the striation and vessel patterns of the retinas, compared them with on-file retinal patterns, and acknowledged Roy as one of the select. The guard then pushed a button to raise the gate. The entire procedure could have been accomplished without the guard, if not for one contingency against which precautions had to be taken. An operative bent on penetrating the agency might have killed Roy, cut out his eyes, and held them up to the camera to be scanned. While the computer conceivably could have been deceived, a guard surely would have noticed this messy ruse. It was unlikely that anyone would go to such extremes to breach the agency's security, but not impossible. These days, sociopaths of singular viciousness were loose in the land. Roy drove into the subterranean garage. By the time he parked and got out of the car, the steel gate had clattered shut again. The dangers of Los Angeles, of democracy run amok, were locked out. His footsteps echoed off the concrete walls and the low ceiling, and he knew that the guard in the basement room could hear them, too. The garage was under audio as well as video surveillance. Access to the high-security elevator was achieved by pressing his right thumb to the glass face of the print scanner. A camera above the lift doors gazed down at him so the distant guard could prevent anyone from entering merely by placing a severed thumb to the glass. No matter how smart machines eventually became, human beings would always be needed. Sometimes that thought encouraged Roy. Sometimes it depressed him, though he wasn't sure why. He rode the elevator to the fourth floor, which was shared by document analysis, substance analysis, and photo analysis. In the photo analysis computer lab, two young men and a middle-aged woman were working at arcane tasks. They all smiled and said good morning because Roy had one of those faces that encouraged smiles and familiarity. Melissa Wicklund, their chief photo analyst in Los Angeles, was sitting at the desk in her office, which was in a corner of the lab. The office had no windows to the outside, but featured two glass walls through which she could watch her subordinates in the larger room. When Roy knocked on the glass door, she looked up from a file that she was reading. "Come in,"